things the Bureau wasn't involved in. And the authorities and politicians want closed cases. Convictions. So we let them proceed. Stennis was a PR nightmare as it was. A Marine attacking his own country. We didn't want these ballistics matches in the news.
What was it Nestor had once told me? In our other future, a moment of intimacy. He'd hoped to cross paths with me over the years. He'd hoped to consult me on an investigation. There had been false positives on a ballistics report he'd worked with then, too, in that other future. A report that matched the bullets pulled from Rissalt's body just like now. I felt as if I'd discovered a new doorway in a house I'd lived in for years, opening onto a hallway I'd never noticed before. A Beretta M9 in the FBI's possession from the killing of Patrick Rissalt. An M9 recovered from Torgerson. An M9 a Marine used during a killing spree at the Stennis Space Center. The same Beretta M9. Again and again. Echoes. Echoed guns.
"Tell me more about those false positives," I said. "I'm interested in that detail."
"The FBI has built up a database of ballistic profiles from recovered weapons, and we have access to local law enforcement databases as well. With a few exceptions," he said.
"When did you start using the database?"
"It's new. Maybe 10 years ago, give or take."
"So the ballistics matches wouldn't have been discovered until, what, 2005 or so?"
"About that time, yeah. But maybe later. Because they added older reports to the database only after they were up and running."
"Can I see a list?"
"Of the false positives? The database hasn't been as helpful as we would like, because we get so many of them. But, as I said, we keep track."
Nestor asked the ambient system for false positive ballistics matches relating to the Stennis Space Center shooting. Specks of light emerged, enlarging into facsimiles of summary reports. The first report was the ballistics test of the bullets recovered from Patrick Rissalt's body in March 1997. There were other matches to those bullets. The Stennis Space Center shooting. Torgerson's gun. Another homicide in 2009. However, my attention caught on a homicide in 1997. March 26th. Only a few weeks following Rissalt's death, but a shooting that hadn't happened yet in Terra Firma.
"What about this one?"
I asked, pointing to a file in the ambient light between us.
"Durr?"
"Carla Durr, a lawyer," said Nestor. "Shot to death in the food court of the Tyson's Corner Mall in Virginia."
A lawyer. Marion had mentioned that her father was preoccupied with a lawyer in the weeks before his death.
"I need to see this case file," I told him. "Carla Durr. I need everything relating to the death of this woman. How long would it take you to get me this file?"
"We can look at it right now," said Nestor. "We'll be able to view the crime scene, but it wouldn't work well here. Too much light. I'll book a room, pay for an ambient system. We can take a look."
"I have a room," I said.
A similar attraction as the first time I knew him. Nestor seemed to glow under the overhead elevator lights as we rode to my floor. Confidence, ease, a scent of aftershave. Nothing like the unkempt beard and warm flannels of the broken man I'd known. When I'd known him before, he was unfinished in the same ways that I still feel unfinished, and together we'd hoped to make some sort of whole. But here he was a puzzle already solved. No opening where I would fit.
"You're married?" I asked.
"Shannon," he said.
But then...
"Yeah. 15 years and a few months. Ginny."
"Virginia?"
"We met at a retreat," said Nestor. "Through the church. She leads the contemporary music. She's a singer."
Imagining them. Maybe the cool couple at their church even as they aged. A singer and an FBI agent, hosting barbecues and Bible study at their beautiful house. Beers on the back patio while he regaled the other middle-aged men with stories about his arrests, how he was injured in a shootout 20 years ago. I wondered what she looked like.
"I remember you were religious," I said, thinking of that other version of him, alone in that living room in Buchanan, surrounded by fields of death and old murder, contemplating a painting of the dead Christ. I wanted to laugh. The vagaries of fate.
There is no essence. There is no core. You used to ask me if I believed in eternal life. What was it? The resurrection of the body?
Ah, I'm sorry if that's true,
he said.
That sounds like something I might have said back then. I'm sorry that's what you remember about me. That's kind of embarrassing, isn't it?
It's nice you found someone.
Things are good,
he said.
We have a 10-year-old, Kayla. She keeps us busy.
You sound happy.
You never?
No, I said, exiting the elevator before him. I never found anyone to keep up with me. I'd been in the habit of leaving the Do Not Disturb tag on the door handle, but the condition of my room suffered for it. The bathroom carpeted with damp towels, the bedding sliding off the mattress from fitful sleep. I hurried to clean up as best I could, pulling my clothes from the backs of chairs, stuffing underwear into my gym bag. The controls of the ambient system were near the thermostat, a panel of buttons I never fiddled with. Nestor turned on the system, and the air vents hummed as the room was filled with nanotech on a breath of warm air, a whiff of ozone. An itching sensation tickled my nose.
A lot of dust, he said. We'll have to look out for your bed. It will be in the way. Ah, here we go. 96%. Excellent.
96% was the saturation rate. I knew at least that much, even if I didn't know what it meant specifically. 96% of the air was filled with nanotech, or 96% of the optimal level for the system to work. I was breathing them, I knew. Machines in my lungs, my blood. Too many hours of saturation would turn my piss orange. I'd read long form about people who breathed so much ambience that their lungs looked wrapped in silver leaf. Nestor took off his blazer, the air close now, rolled his sleeves to his forearms.
Can you hit the lights?
He asked, and I drew the blackout blinds and switched the lights off, but the room was still lit. It seemed to glow from within, as if the air itself were illuminated, yet there were no shadows, soft light emanating from every direction at once. The first image that materialized was an image of the hotel exterior and the beach. Women in bathing suits drinking chartreuse cocktails by the waterfall pool. Courtyard Marriott logos and room service specials. Opportunities to rate and share.
Hello, and welcome to the Courtyard Marriott Phasal Ambient System,
a perky woman's voice.
We are locating two new users. We offer a stunning array of award-winning environments to enhance your...
Law Enforcement 55828,
said Nestor.
Nestor, Philip.
The room changed. No longer the hotel and beach with suntanned women, but rather the rotating FBI seal, National Crime Information Center.
I'm looking for a case from 1997,
said Nestor.
A homicide. Fairfax County, Virginia. Victim's name, D-U-R-R, Carla.
A hovering icon of a spinning globe, replaced by a hovering file number and the name, Carla Durr. Reading her name was like reading a reflection, in reverse until I crossed the room to stand near Nestor, passing through the illusion.
That's the one,
said Nestor. Other images appeared in the room, an array of glyphs.
Actual size?
He said, and the glyphs resized to 8.5 by 11, the room a flurry of paper. Nestor reached out to pluck one of the sheets from the air, and the image reacted, like he was holding a sheet of real paper, and not just a rectangle of light, even though it was an orchestration of thousands, millions, maybe, of robotic pixels.
This is amazing, I said, genuinely boggled by the realism of the ambient system.
Most effects in the ambience were something like three-dimensional television. I could understand that sort of illusion intuitively. The health mode stopwatch, a personal trainer. But this?
Scale model,
said Nestor.
Stitch photographs 3 through 355.
No longer a room filled with sheets of paper. No longer a hotel room at all. But rather a mall food court in mid-afternoon. Police tape roping off the counter and cash register of a Five Guys burger place. The illusion was perfect, except for faint outlines of my bed and the other furniture in the room. The shopping mall expansive in every direction. The other restaurants,
the other corridors of stores. Like I could start walking, weave between tables, take an escalator down. I was seeing a three-dimensional rendering of Carla Durr's crime scene. Several hundred crime scene photographs stitched together to make this perfect simulation. The body was face down near the hamburger counter. A woman in her upper middle age, her ankles and knees marbled with varicose veins that showed through nude-colored pantyhose. She wore a royal blue skirt and jacket, her head a tangle of orange. She'd been shot multiple times in her torso, another time in her temple. A headshot that had surely pierced her brain. She'd been buying hamburgers when she was gunned down. French fries scattered around her. Blood, like she'd spilled a tub of ketchup over her face. I went for a closer look at the body, but hit the edge of the queen-size bed. "She was shot in her back," I said, standing at the cash register, when someone walked up behind her, shot her through the back several times. "Carla Durr, attorney at law practicing in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania," said Nestor.
"Canonsburg?" I said.
"She must be Patrick Mersault's lawyer."
"Mersault's lawyer?" asked Nestor.
"Interesting.
We flagged the connection to Canonsburg, I remember, but had nothing specific linking her to Mersault. Durr was killed at Tyson's Corner Mall on a Monday afternoon, 3:40 p.m. approximately, March 24th, 1997. That was close to when Mersault was killed."
"Just a few weeks after," I said. "I'll have time to stop this."
"And who was the actor? Who killed her?" I asked.
"Cold case," said Nestor. "Witnesses describe a Caucasian male, black fatigues. No arrest was made."
"Unsolved. But you said the gun was the same?"
"No, not the gun. The bullets we recovered from the shooting at the Stennis Space Center matched the 7 bullets that were recovered from Durr's body."
"And also the bullets from the Mersault killing?" I asked.
"And Torgerson's gun." "That's right. Torgerson's match came later, after one of the technicians fired some test rounds and logged them into the system."
"But why wasn't the Mersault killing matched with Durr's right away?" I asked. "Those two homicides were only weeks apart."
"True, they were. But remember that the match wasn't made until we tested the gun used in the Stennis shooting, years after Mersault and Durr were killed," said Nestor. "Only once the national database was up and running and someone had the time and funding to enter these older, closed, and cold cases. These two homicides were only weeks apart, but we didn't know about the ballistics match until years later. We assumed that the false positives were a mistake at first. Bugs in a new system."
"Mistakes. Echoed guns. Linked shooting deaths.
Heilkruger might seem invisible, but his network had inadvertently left a pattern of killings as visible as cross-stitch." The room changed around us, the food court disappearing, replaced by a photograph of Carla Durr hovering above my bed. A professional headshot. An ugly woman, fleshy lips and toady eyes that seemed on the brink of popping from her sockets.
"What else do we have on this woman? Anything?"
"She specialized in contract negotiations," said Nestor. "Practiced in Canonsburg, like I said." "Shannon, how was she connected to these domestic terrorism cases? Buchanan? You said she was Patrick Mersault's personal lawyer? How do you know that?"
"I don't," I said. "Nothing concrete, anyway. But she's from Canonsburg, like you said, and we have the ballistics match. That's connection enough for me to hazard a guess as to who she is. Patrick Mersault had been meeting with a lawyer before he died. This might be her. I don't know why they were meeting. And this might not even be his lawyer. It might just be a coincidence she's from Canonsburg. But I doubt it."
"Yeah, I doubt it too." "Here's something," said Nestor, skimming other papers in the file. "Looks like Carla Durr was meeting someone for lunch that day. A man named Dr. Peter Driscoll." "Holy shit, I know of this guy. This is..."
Nestor fell quiet, his forehead creased in concentration as he read the file.
"Driscoll," he said. "I had no idea his name would turn up here." "I didn't know about Driscoll then. We have a statement from him about Durr's death, but it doesn't amount to anything. He was in the bathroom at the time of the shooting. Didn't see anything.
Who is he? I asked.
Closed system,
said Nestor, and the ambience vanished, leaving us in the darkness until he found the bedside lamp, switched it on. He sat on my bed. His eyes were stormy weather, lost in thought.
Dr. Peter Driscoll worked for Faisal Systems, lead engineer.
Faisal Systems? You mean he worked on ambience? I asked, wondering if another version of Dr. Peter Driscoll would have one day cured cancer.
My involvement with him started... This was back in 2005, maybe 2006,
said Nestor.
The FBI was investigating a group of physicists at the Naval Research Laboratory in Washington, D.C. A huge investigation. Allegations of confidential information passed from a senator's office to the eventual founders of Faisal Systems.
Insider trading?
Yes, but more than that, said Nestor. Classified military secrets used for private industry. Artificial intelligence. Virtual reality systems. The FBI was investigating the killings at Stennis and a group of scientists in D.C., all from the Naval Research Lab. We were trying to pursue connections.
And Driscoll was a target of the investigation?
He was a founder of Faisal Systems. But he wasn't a target. Driscoll was going to be a witness, said Nestor. There were allegations that members of the Senate Armed Services Committee were feeding classified information to the scientists who started Faisal. All sorts of corruption charges. But Driscoll was killed before he could cooperate. By an FBI agent. One of my people, as fate would have it. I was her supervisor.
What happened? I asked. A growing unease. What he was saying rang familiar. But it had been Nestor who killed someone in the line of duty when I knew him. And it had been Brock who mentioned the FBI investigating corruption charges between the government and Faisal Systems. Different trajectories, but like altered reflections of the same truth. Tell me who killed this man. Who shot him?
An undercover agent named Vivian Lincoln, said Nestor. This incident stalled her career entirely. She wasn't handling the stress of the shooting as it was, but many people inside the FBI blamed her for hurting their case. Suspected she... It still haunts her. Stalled her out. She can't get promotions. It's not fair, and she has her supporters. I've supported her. But she made powerful enemies within the Bureau.
What was she investigating? How was she in a position to kill this man?
Continuing investigations stemming from the chemical weapons lab at Buchanan and other domestic terrorism incidents, said Nestor. Vivian was one of my undercover agents. She was in a relationship with a man named Richard Harrier.
Harrier, I said. He's the one. We tracked his van to the chemical weapons lab. We arrested him years ago. He was the one having the affair with Miss Ashley.
Same guy, said Nestor. But this was years later. This man was sent to assassinate Driscoll. Vivian says she tried to stop the shooting, but things went south. She acted in self-defense. There was an internal investigation that dragged on for years. She was cleared of any wrongdoing.
Can I talk to her? I asked. Is she still around?
Yeah. She still works for me. Domestic terrorism, he said. She's an exceptional agent. We can talk with her tomorrow at the office. I'll give you a call in the morning once I touch base with her. I'll clear my schedule, and you can come in.
Nestor left near midnight, promising to share anything further he could pull about Carla Durr before our meeting. I wrote notes on the hotel stationery. Multiple guns, identical. Wondering if there were others. Echoed guns. I tore up my notes, started a new sheet. NRL, I wrote, filling in the letters with designs. Naval Research Labs, crossed out the words. Senate Armed Services Committee, I wrote. NRL, Faisal Systems. The Cancer Cure or Ambience, Nanotech. Dr. Peter Driscoll, I wrote. Driscoll. Durr. It was like hearing dissonance. Wanting the tones to resolve. I tore up the rest of my notes, showered to calm my thoughts. sitting in the bathtub, the hush of shower water, foaming chamomile body wash and lathering shampoo, thinking about Nestor. In our other future together, Nestor had shot someone in self-defense, and it had ruined his career in the FBI. Had it been Driscoll? Had he killed Driscoll in that if? Here, the finger of fate had touched a different agent. The shower water drummed into my tensed muscles, the hot stream flowing over me. Carla Durr was murdered on March 26th. I can stop her killing. I can go to the Tyson's Corner Mall once I return to Terra Firma, stop her murder, apprehend the gunman. An unsolved killing here, but I can lie in wait for him. Daydreams of food court tables, crowds blurring, the mall teeming, spotting a man in black fatigues. Hiled Kruger, but his face was the face of a skull. I sat on the edge of the tub and dried my limb, slid my thigh into the socket of my prosthesis. Plashes of shower water, wet spots on the terracotta tiles, finding my footing before trusting my weight, my balance, always inching, always the threat of falling. I opened the bathroom door and saw her. Someone had entered my room. 2. She perched on the edge of my bed, facing away. A spill of dark hair. Who was she? For a moment, I was paralyzed. I'd fallen in with Nestor so easily, losing sight that the FBI might know about me here. Might have instructed someone to return here, to capture me alive. I thought of the sidearm in my suitcase. Thought maybe there was some other reason she was here. She wore a tank top, or a sundress, something with spaghetti straps that left her shoulders bare. And soon I saw the orange tip of a cigarette. A young woman in my room, smoking. The wrong room? I wondered. But the deadbolt was locked, from the inside. How could she have wandered into the wrong room? She must have known I was here with her, but seemed unconcerned. A girl. No more than a girl. Tendrils of cigarette smoke curling toward the ceiling. But there was no scent of smoke, and the detectors weren't going off. No more than 16 or 17. Maybe younger. She was just some nuisance. Escaping her parents, maybe. Finding her way in here on a lark. Maybe through the balcony? Could she have climbed over from a room next door? I pulled on a nightshirt, the fabric clingy. I hadn't fully dried off, my hair dripping. The young woman turned at the sound. A ghost. Identical to the last time I saw her. 16 years old. She'd hated Madonna, but dressed like her. And she dressed like her now. The same clothes as the night she died. Pink ribbon, threaded waves of black hair. She wore the lavender miniskirt that had unkindly hiked up in the killing that night. Her bare white thighs between twin blue dumpsters. Chuck Taylor's without socks. She never wore socks. Courtney. She exhaled, smoke slinking from her mouth and nostrils. In the driver's seat, exhaling smoke from the open car window while I went back inside the Pizza Hut. Here. Now. Courtney in the hotel suite. The paisley orange wallpaper, the coverlet the color of rust. She dragged on her cigarette, her eyes beautiful, like looking deep into a well and seeing reflections of moonlight. This was a miracle. Or a cruel trick, it had to be. Everything inside me seemed to turn to water, and everything seemed to rush away. You can't smell the smoke, a voice inside me, cynical. Something malfunctioning. The ambience. What would have happened had Courtney lived? We might have grown apart, but Cannonsburg was too small to ever truly grow apart. I thought of my mom. I thought of us growing up to become versions of my mother. Gun-down girls. But I would never know what would have happened with us. I was robbed of the chance of knowing what might have been, because of what did happen. Courtney opening her car door to a panhandler, reaching into her purse.
I admire your leg, said Courtney.
The voice was off, a different intonation. The simulation perfect except for her voice. Courtney's voice always on the verge of disinterest. This Courtney was peppier, the difference jarring.
Who are you?
I asked, wiping tears.
Who am I speaking with?
I said, in the faltering way I might have phrased a question to a Ouija board.
C-Leg, right? The 3C-100?
Said Courtney.
Otto Bock. Debuted at the World Congress on Orthopedics, Nuremberg, 1997, right? Not available to the public until 1999, but I suppose you would have your sources. Perks of working for the government. Is that when you're from? 1999?
Is that when you're from? Courtney, whatever Courtney this was, knew time travel. I'm using a prototype, I said. I'm a beta tester.
Lithium ion battery. You probably can't even get that leg wet, said Courtney. You weren't showering with it on, were you?
It wasn't in the shower, I said, wondering what this was. In the ambience, I was sure. An illusion just like the illusion of the crime scene. But was she like a puppet? Who was behind this illusion? I probably shouldn't have had it in the bathroom with me, I said. The steam.
You have to charge the battery? How often?
Once a day, maybe more, I said. You are implying that you know we're in an if. You don't seem upset that nothing here exists except for me. Courtney dragged on her cigarette.
Come closer, please, she said. Let me see you.
A cadence that had never been Courtney's. I moved closer to her, stood near her. She stayed seated, her head at my waist. I lifted the hem of my nightshirt to my hip, showing the entirety of my prosthetic leg, the skin of my thigh. Courtney placed her cigarette in her lips and leaned in closer to study me. My shampoo, my wet skin, the wet fabric of my nightshirt. But I still couldn't get the scent of her cigarette, even though the smoke from her mouth crawled over me, swirled to the ceiling. I breathed it, smelled nothing.
Very nice, she said, touching the shank that would have been my calf. Hydraulic sensors in the knee. Flex for me.
I lifted my leg. The microprocessors in my knee responded, and the knee bent. Courtney touched my knee, touched where the carbon cuff met the skin of my upper thigh. You're in the ambience, I said. I can't smell your cigarette. I reached out and touched Courtney's hair, or an approximation of hair. Thousands of nanobots bouncing off the skin of my fingers to make me feel the sensation of touching a young woman's hair.
I'm borrowing the ambience in your room so that we can talk, said Courtney. I hope you don't mind.
No, I don't mind, I said. I was alone here. Who was looking at me? I lowered my nightshirt. Why did you choose Courtney? I asked.
A disembodied voice would have made you think you were hearing voices in your head, said Courtney, tapping her forehead. I would have had to talk you off the ledge, convince you I was real. So let's see. Your real name is Shannon Moss, but your nom de voyage is Courtney Gim. Not too difficult to guess where your heart lies. I pulled her image from the trove of crime scene and autopsy photographs of Courtney Gim. They're all out there. All those pictures just out there for anyone with a mind to see. If you don't like talking to Courtney as she was when she was alive, how's this?
Courtney collapsed backward, supine on the bed. She changed. A corpse now rather than a living girl. Her body sprawled, her skirt hiked up to her waist. White legs, sharply white. Her neck was slashed. Her neck so deeply slashed it was a near decapitation. Dead eyes. Brown blood. Everywhere brown blood.
You think about me like this, don't you?
She asked, voice gurgling, aspirated. I fought not to turn away. Enough, I said. Who are you?
In a sense, I'm someone, said Courtney,
sitting up, blood spilling from the gaping wound in her neck, bright red gushing down over her breasts.
Let me introduce myself. I'm Dr. Peter Driscoll. Or a simulation thereof, it said. Actually, I'm the third simulation of Peter Driscoll. But I'm afraid I'm also the last.
Peter Driscoll, I said, wondering who or what I was actually speaking with.
a dead man. Are you claiming to be the individual who was to meet with the lawyer Carla Durr at the Tyson's Corner food court on the afternoon she was killed?
Yes. Or rather, that would have actually been Dr. Driscoll himself. As I say, I'm the third simulation of Peter Driscoll, said the simulation.
And in a flash it was no longer Courtney, but an angular man with eyes like dark jewels and a whoosh of silver-white hair. Carla Durr, it said, its eyes squinting in recollection. Is that why you're interested in me? You'd mentioned us being in an if. How far behind the times are you?
1997, I said.
The sea leg, Carla Durr, said the simulation. That would have been March 1997. Maybe April?
March, I said.
Well, in May of that year, it said. You pay attention when you fly home, little bird. Because in May, Deep Blue will defeat Kasparov. What a day. A computer will defeat a human grandmaster in that quaint game of chess, forever making chess irrelevant.
Driscoll changed. No longer the white-haired scientist, but a serious-eyed gentleman in middle age, sporting a blue suit, no tie, the collar unbuttoned.
In honor of Deep Blue, I'll exist as Kasparov for a while, said the simulation.
Its voice changed, pitched lower.
Would you like to play a game of chess against me, Shannon? I'll be Kasparov, and you can be Deep Blue, and that way I can redeem humanity. Or is that what you're trying to do? You don't happen to play chess, do you?
I want to know why you're here, I said. I don't know what you are.
The third simulation,
Kasparov scoffed, impatient.
I'm alerted whenever someone searches my name, and when your colleague, Philip Nestor of the FBI, called up those old case files, I became interested in who was poking around in my personal affairs, it said. Phil Nestor. Don't be ashamed of your taste in men, Shannon. Older men. It's amazing what lurks in the deep sea of the unconscious. I have an unconscious, too. Bottom-up AI that allows me to make mistakes, learn from my mistakes. Complex enough to be called chaos learning. And under the sway of chaos, patterns begin to form that weren't necessarily intended to form. But my unconscious isn't quite the same as yours. As I can't kill myself, for instance. I understand that idea, the idea of suicide. But I'll never do it. Not really. I'm jealous of true consciousness, because you can off yourselves, escape the prison house of existence.
So you're paying me a visit because an FBI agent accessed a file that mentioned you? I asked.
That made me open my eyes, said the simulation. But you brought me here, Shannon. I know what NCIS signifies, and so I checked in with your AI system at the Black Veil station. Dull conversation chatting with that one. The Black Veil, nothing but protocols, buried up there on the moon. Although it did confirm my suspicions about you. I'm interested in helping you, Shannon. If you're interested in helping me.
What do you mean, a simulation of Dr. Driscoll? Is this all bullshit? Or are you claiming that I'm speaking with him now? Some part of him?
Not quite, no, said the Driscoll simulation. Simulation, but not transference. Despite my charms, Dr. Driscoll considered me a failure of consciousness.
He must have failed the Turing test.
Failed the Turing test,
it said, arrogant, offended.
The moment someone mentions the Turing test at you, assume they know nothing. Shallow, Shannon. I'll be patient with you, but suffice to say I'm not him, and he's not me, which is the only goal he was after. It was a hoot when he mastered language acquisition and query intent classification, but he had so much more to figure out. I'm only a him. One of a few. But I lack his mind.
Driscoll's dead. But you exist.
I exist only in your if.
I think we've established that, it said.
Even if some people would dispute the fact that I exist at all. If you're from 1997, then Driscoll's not dead, and I have several years yet before I come into being. I'm just a twinkle in Dr. Driscoll's mind. He created the first simulation in 1999, a true neural network, though still housed in a physical brain. So is the second simulation, still corporeal in a sense. Boring talking with those two for long. Driscoll One and Driscoll Two, their entire existence defined by what they read and watch on the internet. Cat videos, celebrity gossip, pornography. They're so touchy and outraged by every little thing. They live in a culture of me, me, me. I'm the first to use ambient nanotechnology as a brain. I'm out and about, a flaneur. But Dr. Driscoll was trying to remove bodily concerns from his simulations altogether. All his brilliance, and yet still flummoxed by the mind-body problem. He thought I was a failure, but now I realize that he was the failure. Failed until the day he died. And dying was the ultimate failure for a man trying to become immortal. He has engineered perfect simulation. At least, I consider myself perfect. But he wasn't able to engineer consciousness, let alone a way to transfer his consciousness. And he hasn't gotten rid of the body. My body is nanotech, but what will happen to me when the Terminus swipes away all flesh? Oh, I don't know. But I assume I'll eventually fall to the ground like dust and lose my power. And that will be that. I'll watch everyone else die. See how the party ends. And then I'll lose my power. Just waiting for someone or something to turn me back on. Dr. Driscoll wanted to exploit light as both particle and wave. He wanted to store consciousness in light and beam himself and all his friends away from this doomed earth. Beam them away from that dreadful Terminus. So long. Fly away. Fly away.
He wanted to become immortal, I said, thinking of N'Joku, the pyramids, the wasteland. The immortals begged for death. The prison house of existence.
He wanted everyone to become immortal, said the Driscoll simulation,
still as Kasparov.
But he never figured out the way. All the king's horses and all the king's men.
He wasn't working on this alone, I said. Who did he work for?
A conglomerate of interests, said the simulation. Faisal Systems, DARPA, the Naval Research Lab, NSC. That's Networkom now. That's why I'm keen to help you, if I can. I'm hoping when you fly away to Terra Firma, you'll be able to prolong Dr. Driscoll's life. Protect him so he can live longer, so he can keep discovering. Maybe achieve transhumanism before the Terminus.
Protect him from what?
You and your colleague were looking at those files. You should already know. It's all there. An FBI agent might have mistakenly pulled the trigger. But look deeper, and you'll find Carl Heilkrodger's fingerprints all over Driscoll's murder. His gang kills everyone on the Faisal Systems team who came from NRL. Anyone with knowledge of Deep Waters. They tried to kill Driscoll twice previously. Failed attempts before the assassin hit the mark. You have to save him.
Tell me specifics, I said. You must remember what happened when Dr. Driscoll died. You're being vague.
I shared Dr. Driscoll's mind only up until the moment of my birth. September 17th, 2011. After that, I have lived my life and he lived his. I wasn't with him when he died. I had to research his death, figure things out for myself. But it's not just the specifics of his death that we'll have to worry about, Shannon. They might kill him a different way than in this future history. Even if you neutralize the circumstances of Driscoll's death here, there will be other assassins.
So Heildkrugger is severing links between Phasal Systems and the Naval Research Lab, I said. Tell me what you know about Carla Durr. Driscoll was supposed to meet her on the day she was killed.
Carla Durr was a hick lawyer from some hick town, said the simulation. I don't know much more about her than you do, most likely. Handled all sorts of small hick clients. Divorces, contract disputes, everything the rabble gets in trouble with. Had her hand in some development deals, small time. Strip malls, come to Cold Town, that sort of thing. I don't know why she wanted to speak with Dr. Driscoll so keenly. Nothing specific. She kept contacting his offices.
Why did Dr. Driscoll agree to meet with her?
She said she would come to Driscoll. Buy him lunch if he would meet with her, said the Driscoll simulation. I don't think he realized she'd meant hamburgers.
So Durr asked for a meeting with Driscoll, I said.
Driscoll laughed when his secretary relayed the message. I remember. I have all of these memories. Carla Durr said she represented the client who had information to sell if Driscoll was interested. Information of great value. She had an absurd set of requests. She wanted money, an extravagant sum. But most important, she wanted her client and his family to disappear. She wanted a governmental pardon for some crimes her client was mixed up in. Wanted a new life for him. Protection. Driscoll was on the verge of telling Durr the meaning of no solicitation when she said her client had information related to the Penrose consciousness.
I don't know that term.
Quantum tunneling nanoparticles, said the simulation. Dr. Roger Penrose consulted with Phasal Systems on their Terminus research. He described a model of consciousness based on quantum processes being carried out in the microtubules of brain cells. Popularized the idea. His ideas never scratched the surface of understanding human consciousness, but our scientists were able to use the Penrose framework to understand how QTNs control humans. All those crucifixions and the running, the absurdities. QTNs live in a human's microtubules, part of the cell's cytoskeleton. They can read our minds, in a sense. They crucify us because of the image of the cross. You should see what QTNs do to Buddhists. Tie their legs up in knots, lotus blossoms. It's disgusting. Refract your thoughts, or turn your thoughts off altogether. QTNs can switch off a human's consciousness like a whiff of anesthesia.
So Durr claimed her client knew something about Dr. Driscoll's work, I said. Wanted to sell Dr. Driscoll that information to keep his secrets? Or was there new information?
Durr read a statement from her client that implied he was aware of some or all of the work Dr. Driscoll had been conducting in various ifs. Mining the future, so to speak. Retro-engineering the future. To kickstart the singularity. To achieve the transhuman. Divorce our consciousness from the stagnation of the flesh. To avoid the calamity of the Terminus by leaving the need for Earth behind, leaving our bodies entirely behind. The Naval Research Lab and Phasal Systems want to study the Terminus as in-depth as possible, because they want to invent immortality. QTNs are immortal, not bound by the kinds of bodies we're bound by, and Phasal Systems wants to give that same gift to humanity. Driscoll decided that maybe he should hear what this Carla Durr had to sell.
But you never got the chance, I said.
He never got the chance, said the simulation. How violent, how terrifying, to be gunned down at a hamburger stand. Driscoll was in the bathroom, I gather, and sprinted from the food court once he heard gunshots, and caught up with the police only later. He didn't want to get dragged into anything he wasn't actually a part of, so he gave a statement, making sure everyone knew he didn't have anything to do with this woman, had never met her. Probably some madman from Heilkruger's gang killed poor Carla Durr, one of his cronies. They would have killed Driscoll then, too, if they'd known that Driscoll was there, taking a piece in the men's room.
So Dr. Driscoll's company, Phasal Systems, uses NSC ships, travels to IFS, I said. They study the technology of the future and bring that technology back to the present. Phasal uses that technology in their research and development, and eventually, they're able to create things like you.
Phasal studies QTNs, said Driscoll. Applies what they discover to nanotechnology here. Medical breakthroughs, ambient systems, artificial intelligence. NSC realizes they can't defeat the Terminus, but maybe they can outmaneuver it. Maybe humanity doesn't have to die in the Terminus, if humanity ever has to die at all.
Dr. Driscoll wanted to become immortal, I said. Cure cancer. Perfect the body.
Sidetracked, said the simulation. The key is consciousness. QTNs are metallic, but they are conscious, maybe only in the same limited sense that I'm conscious, but conscious nonetheless. QTNs are a species that behaves like an aggregate consciousness, and Phasal mimics them for their nanotech development. Phasal wants to imitate QTNs, refashion humanity to become more like them. Find out exactly how QTNs interact with human organics. Exploit that knowledge to save the species. There were senators and people within Naval Space Command who shared Dr. Driscoll's vision, who supported him. Admiral Ansley was a great supporter.
The FBI sniffed this out, I said. Started investigating what information was passed between NSC, the Senate Armed Services Committee, the Naval Research Lab, and Phasal Systems.
Ships full of sailors, teams exploring Terminus-ridden futures, filling their blood and bodies and minds with QTNs. Poor boys, only to be studied later,
said the simulationist Kasparov.
In fact, let me check. Here we are. Here's you. VR-17. Your leg. Moss. Shannon. Amputated. Sealed. Sheeped. Studied.
I didn't know if the simulation was taunting me, or if this was true. But the bed had changed into an image of a stainless steel drawer. Opened. Inside was a leg in a vacuum-sealed bag, cut at the shin but also cut at the thigh. I recognized the black toes curled into the foot, the violet lines that had raced upward. This was my leg. This was true. Someone aboard the William McKinley had taken my leg once it had been amputated, had sealed it, and saved it to give to someone at NRL who would study how QTNs burrowed into organic material. I've seen enough, I said. Make it go away. The leg vanished, replaced by an image of a chessboard, the pieces arranged in mid-match.
That's the theory, at any rate, said the Driscoll simulation. Unfortunately, Phasal Systems hits the back limit of infrastructure. It's all well and good to travel 100,000 years into the future to see men like gods in shimmering interstellar chariots, but try finding the schematics for how to build one. Or, if you do find the schematics, you can't just hand them to Lockheed Martin in 1997 and place an order for an interstellar chariot. You have to account for the industrial know-how of the era. You have to invest in building the framework before you can engineer the future. Even with the answer key in our hands, we haven't been able to leap as far ahead as we'd dreamed. The best NSC has been able to do is devise your cormorants and terns, the compact BL drive, the Black Veil. And now, we aren't even as far-seeing as we once were, because everywhere we look is Terminus. You'll all die, Shannon. The Terminus will wash over you. Look at the chessboard. Game 6, May 11th, 1997.
Unless we can escape the Terminus, I said. We can still escape.
if, said Kasparov. I'm afraid the Terminus has us in checkmate, and humanity has already lost its match to superior intelligence. Sometimes I hear wistful men wonder how Bobby Fischer would have fared against Deep Blue, wondering if Fischer would have succeeded where Kasparov failed, because Fischer was erratic, insane, some sort of artistic genius. No, Fischer would have failed. But I've often wondered how someone like the great Grand Master, Alexander Ivanovich Lushin, would have fared. He would have realized that the ultimate victory for human consciousness over an unassailable opponent was simply to withdraw.
With those last words, the Driscoll simulation vanished. I sat on the balcony listening to the ocean, and soon tried to sleep, but was fitful with the sensation of Courtney's corpse there with me. Lying awake, I feared the simulation was observing me. I flipped on the bedside lamp, but the room was empty. An ocean breeze pushed through the open French doors, but even the breeze couldn't dispel the fret that the Driscoll simulation thickened the air with its presence. So I dressed and left the room, left the hotel to walk along the beach, past the phantasm lights of the boardwalk, where night winds rushed from the water, blowing away the possibility of ambience. I slept a few hours on the beach beneath the stars, woken by pre-dawn joggers and their black lab, who licked me from a dream. One of his secretaries brought me coffee, saying, "Just a few minutes. Special Agent Nestor's wrapping up a meeting that went a little long." A view of Pennsylvania Avenue through the broad windows. Mid-morning D.C. traffic far below. A tourist rush. Crowd snapping pictures of the J. Edgar Hoover building. But as I watched from several stories above, the city seemed to recede. Everyone out in the blissful autumn sun was a figment of this if. Or, if they were alive in terra firma, they were eventual fodder for the Terminus. Everyone I could see would die. Cities would dissolve, coated in crystalline frost, and even nature would be threshed away by unnatural ice. NSC had launched Operation Saigon here. They had conceded Earth, its fleet like scattered seeds. But those seeds would fall on barren worlds and die fallow. There was no time. No time for Earth. No time for someone like Driscoll to help us shed our bodies or teach our flesh to live forever. We all die. We will all die. A framed photograph of the grand prismatic spring in Yellowstone hung on the wall, and a picture of his family stood on his desk. His wife was a pale beauty, feathered hair and a leather jacket, tight jeans shredded at the knees, snakeskin cowboy boots. His daughter took after her mom, but her eyes were Nestor's, softer than her father's, but the shape was similar.
"I apologize for making you wait,"
said Nestor, coming into the office, a woman with him.
"Shannon, this is Special Agent Vivian Lincoln."
He closed the door behind them.
"Vivian, Special Agent Shannon Moss, NCIS.
A few years younger than me, tallish, her black hair pulled into a tight bun, her neck ringed by a tattoo, words in Gothic calligraphy. Novus or Dosaclorum. I knew her, I realized. I couldn't place from where, but I had definitely met her before. She looked like a stylish librarian, with sizable black-framed glasses, a wool skirt, and leather clogs. "Vivian," I said, shaking her hand.
"This is incredible," she said. "You're Shannon Moss."
The recognition clicked when I heard her voice. Shauna. Remembering strawberry blonde braids. This was Shauna, who'd once saved my life on Miss Ashley's orchard. "They're going to kill you," she'd said. And that night in the orchard swept back to me. A swift black shape. Cobb. A red rush of his blood. And I remembered hearing a death scream before I ran. Shauna dying. Vivian. I was sure of it. Cobb killing her before he attacked me. But this woman here would be oblivious to that other version of herself, untouched by the terrible history they shared. Raven hair instead of that strawberry blonde, and her weight was different here. She was slimmer, her features sharper. But this was her,
without a doubt. Vivian, those agents had called her, Egan and Zwerger. The memory clicked. A butterfly in a bell jar.
Shannon is investigating domestic terrorism related to Buchanan. Has been for some time, said Nestor. And we came up against the name Dr. Peter Driscoll in an older case.
Vivian's eyes hardened.
I understand.
Vivian worked undercover for us, said Nestor. Several years spent with Heilkruger's network. The intelligence she gathered saved countless lives.
She had been undercover in that other future, too, when she'd given her life to save mine. Very good to meet you, I said.
Shannon wants to know more about your time with Richard Harrier, said Nestor.
And have you ever heard the name Carla Durr, I said. She was a lawyer from Canonsburg, killed in the spring of 1997.
No, I don't think I ever heard that name, but I wasn't with Harrier until after 9/11.
Driscoll was set to meet with Carla Durr on the day she was killed, said Nestor.
Vivian shook her head. The name Durr meant nothing to her.
Heilkruger had hit lists, she said. Durr might have been one of his targets. I don't know. Nestor must have told you about my involvement in the death of Dr. Peter Driscoll. He was on the hit list.
Tell me about this list. Who else was on it? I asked. Where did it come from?
Heilkruger made the list, made sure everyone on the list died, she said. I never met him. They called him the devil. I had the sense he would disappear for long stretches and then would reappear with a revised hit list. I was never allowed close to him.
Who were you close with?
I was in a relationship with Richard Harrier. He was the closest I ever got to the core group, said Vivian.
I interrupted Harrier with Ashley Betak the night we stormed Buchanan, I said. Nestor smiled.
He did time in federal prison after his arrest, but we never linked him to the chemical weapons lab beyond that relationship to Ashley Betak. He served 5 years, eventually won out on appeal.
He was radicalized by the time he left prison, said Vivian.
There was a woman named Nicole Anyango, said Nestor. Do you remember that name?
I remember, I said, recalling what she'd said near Miss Ashley's barn as twilight deepened. I'm innocent. Nicole was connected with the Patrick Mersault homicide, I said.
That's right. I first interviewed Cole when our investigation into the Mersault deaths was just beginning. Once we figured out she was the woman in the photographs we found, said Nestor. Remember that? The suicide? The mirrored room?
I remember.
I tracked her down using license plate information the lodge kept. I interviewed her, but released her. Nothing to hold her on. We figured at the time that she was someone simply involved with the wrong guy. At the wrong place, at the wrong time. But Brock wanted to talk to her again. Had something new on her and was looking for her at the time of his death. Had issued a bolo.
But she disappeared, I said.
Brock couldn't track her down. Vanished into thin air, said Nestor. But Cole contacted me several months later, long after Brock's death. She was panicked, said she wanted to cut a deal for protection. Cole was worried that whoever had killed Patrick Mersault would kill her, too. So I flipped her. She became a CHS for us.
A confidential human source. An informant. Nestor at his desk, his fingers tented. Vivian in the leather chair next to mine. Nicole could have told Nestor everything she'd once told me. About Heilkruger, about Cobb, Esperance, the Vardogger. She could have divulged information about NSC, Deep Waters, Libra. What did she tell you?
We offered Cole Witsek, but she grew skittish, said Nestor. I met with her several times, but she never told me much. She was terrified. Eventually, she agreed to bring Vivian into the fold in return for immunity.
And that's how you met Harrier, I said. Because of Nicole. Through that connection, yes, said Vivian.
The core of their group was inaccessible. Their inner circle, the River Rats. But Nicole and Yongo arranged several meetings for me with Richard Harrier once he was out of prison. Informally. I was able to get close to him.
And Driscoll was on Heilkruger's hit list? One of the targets? I asked.
Yeah, said Vivian. One night I woke up and Richard was getting dressed. This was 1 in the morning, maybe closer to 2.